From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Shayna Stulen, Washington-based political and national security correspondent. Joining me on the panel via Skype are J.J. Green, national security correspondent for WTOP here in D.C. and host of the Target USA podcast, and Richard Lefton-Dress, TVA Nouvelle Canada's correspondent. Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The U.S. begins to reopen after weeks of a shutdown. We will look at the debate playing out over safety concerns, plus the president ordering meat plants to stay open despite thousands of workers getting sick. But will workers show up? And we're going to get a global view of the pandemic, where other countries are holding on the question of reopening. Again, I am joined by J.J. Green from WTOP and Richard Lefton-Dress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada. We're all talking from our respective homes. We're practicing social distancing. And when we look at those social distancing guidelines, some states, around two dozen in this country, are beginning to ease those guidelines. They are in the process of reopening, even as the U.S. hit just a horrific milestone. Over 60,000 people have died. There are over 1 million confirmed cases. One of the first states to begin reopening is Georgia. And so, JJ, can you tell us how that reopening is playing out in that state?
Well, it's playing out very carefully, but I have to say, from the people that I've spoken to and just looking at it from a security point of view, there are some serious concerns about it actually taking place. One of the big problems that's been laid out from the very beginning of this coronavirus pandemic is the possibility for second wave infections, or the possibility that it can essentially blow up in a rural area or in areas that were previously unaffected on a moment's notice. Speaking with Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo, who is a world-renowned epidemiologist and scholar at the Johns Hopkins University Health Center this week, she mentioned that we have to realize that the situation with coronavirus is this. It's social distancing was a pause button. It didn't kill the virus. It didn't stop the virus. So places that are reopening, there's a possibility they may reopen too soon. We don't know, of course, what's happening. Specifically in Georgia, we know certain things have opened, gyms, and I think certain restaurants have opened with certain types of restrictions. There are other places as well, like salons and tattoo parlors, those kinds of things. Those are going to be watched very carefully, but I can tell you for sure, the leaders in Georgia are on two different sides of this issue. Some say it shouldn't have happened. Some say it should. We're going to be watching very carefully to see what indeed takes place there.
And to your point about this fear of another spike in cases if these states open too soon, and it's not only Georgia, there are around two dozen, as I mentioned, Florida, Colorado is also looking to reopen. So, Richard, the question is, if there is another spike in cases, and again, it's just a prediction here, but does the state shut down again, or is that a bell you can't unring?
Well, this is the main question. At what point do you tell people who have been confined for weeks to you allow them to go out, and then you tell them, no, we just go back to what we at the end hated to do? It's going to be complicated. There's an experiment at the moment in California, for instance, where the governor Newsom allowed beaches to reopen, and they were literally invaded by people who just wanted to be out, wanted to enjoy being outside and on the beach, and they were so crowded that he's walking this back and he's closing back the beaches. It's going to be very interesting to see how people are going to react to this. And what is also very interesting is that we're listening to the president, and yesterday, Wednesday, he said very openly that he doesn't intend to extend the social distancing guidelines. So the message at the top level is to say, we are not going to extend what the experts think have been very helpful in slowing down the virus. And so it's also to a lot of people, even if polls after polls show how people are worried of the virus still being around or getting stronger than it used to be, that the message is to say, I think you should go out. I think things should go back to some sort of normalcy. I was looking around, Shayna, and even in Canada, where we have been very cautious, in Quebec, for instance, they are definitely opening elementary school and daycares starting May 11 because they want to free people to allow them to go to work, free parents. So even in areas outside of the U.S., outside of Republican states, for instance, where people have been cautious, there's this strong push to go ahead, even if the threat seems to be around still.
Yeah, and polls are also pretty confusing because they show that at the same time, Americans want to see social distancing guidelines remain in place for now, but they also show that Americans are very worried about the economy. And JJ, to what Richard was talking about, the guidance from the president, what are you hearing from the different states about the guidance they are getting from the president? Because it seems to be we're getting different messages coming from the president about easing social distancing guidelines.
Well, that's the problem. Many of the states aren't really sure, based on the people that I've spoken to, and in all transparency, I haven't spoken to a lot of different state leaders, just a handful of people in various locations. Like here in the Washington area, there are three states, three jurisdictions, and of course in West Virginia, of course, the New York area, and a couple of the other hard hit areas. And one of the big problems that I've discovered is that the intelligence that's necessary to inform decisions on this virus and what to do about it is lacking. We've known that from the very beginning. And a part of the reason for that is because China didn't tell us the truth in the beginning about when it started. And we still have lots of countries that are not giving up legitimate, real data about how their countries are being impacted. And as this wave pushes across the U.S., are we hearing the right things? Are we getting the right information from the president, from the White House, from the government? And do they actually know what the best information is? The medical officials that I've spoken to as well have said, we need a better national response and intelligence gathering apparatus for the disease itself, but we also need a much better international intelligence gathering process so that that information can be fed out to all countries and then trickle down to the states in each country. And I can tell you, New York, that area, the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area, Boston, this area, there are a lot of people that are confused about what they're hearing, and they're just taking it step by step, putting together their own panels to discover and discuss what they find about it. So there is some reticence to say, okay, fine, we'll take what the White House says and run with it.
And to your point about intelligence, the Washington Post, JJ, and I'm going to stick with you because I know this is really a focus of your reporting. The Washington Post has reported that the president, in his daily intelligence briefings, his PDB, was being warned by the intelligence community about the pandemic, even as he was continuing to downplay the threat. What are you hearing about this? What is your reporting on this issue?
You're exactly right. Greg Miller and Ellen Nakashima did an amazing job on that story. And I had been following that myself. And we posted a story this week. And basically, it says the coronavirus intelligence void has impeded the response. And you can find it at WTOP.com on my page. But I had been asking national security officials at the White House and at the National Security Council since March. What did they know and when did they know it? Eventually, I got a statement from Hogan Gidley, the principal deputy press secretary for the president, to the White House earlier this week. It's a pretty angry response, saying that it was disgusting that the media, and of course, they said the Democrats, were making this a big issue. But what I had been hearing and what I have heard now is that there is still significant worry that we're not getting the complete and full picture, not because the U.S. intelligence community's professionals aren't trying their hardest, but there are questions about how it's being impacted politically. There are questions as well about how it's being impacted internationally, because again, China, North Korea, there are other countries as well that simply aren't being truthful about what kind of COVID-19 impact, what kind of impact it's having on their country. And the intelligence that's necessary to make these decisions simply is not there. And yes, in addition to those dozen or so briefings that the president supposedly had in the PDB, there were others. There was one of his closest trade advisors sent him a very concerning memo earlier in the year. There were reports from the National Center for Medical Intelligence in November of last year that were sent to the White House about this. So the warnings have been there. The question is, how has this information been used, and has it been used effectively?
Yeah, and we're going to get to what did China know and how that might impact the future relationship between the U.S. and China later on in the show when we take a look at how other countries are faring. Richard, I want to ask you, here in DC, cases are still rising. We don't have a clear timeline on when the region is going to be reopening. And yet the Senate, but not the House, will be returning to work. Now, one argument I heard is that lawmakers are essential workers, and like other workers on the front lines, they should be coming to work. What do you make of that argument, Richard?
Well, that's the argument that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is putting forward. The main point being that they should lead by example and show that the sacrifice that so many essential workers are doing all over the country should have some sort of echo here in the federal capital. The worry is that at least over 50%, let's be clear, are over 65 years old. So they're a potential target group for the COVID-19. Is it a good idea to bring these people together again, even if they take a certain number of precautions? We just don't wish that this happened. But if anybody gets sick, it's exactly the wrong message that will be sent around the country. But again, like everything now in the United States, everything becomes political, and the House has decided not to go forward on this. The House, led by the Democrats, has decided not to go forward on bringing back everybody in town. So at this very moment, we are at this point where the Republicans and the Senate and the Republicans in Congress are, for a good number of them, because there's a certain resistance, a good number of them are saying we should not only be around, but push for a reopening of the economy, reopening of the country. So let's go ahead with the message that the White House wants to bring forward. Too many people have been laid off. Too many people have been filing for unemployment claims. This economy has to restart. Let's not go necessarily too far on this political lane, but the president himself, during his briefings at the White House, insists constantly on the fact that he had, according to him, and I quote him, the greatest economy in the history of the country, and he lost this in few days, in few weeks. He just wants this back to show the Americans that he deserves being reelected in November.
Right. And then, of course, as we've been talking about, you've got this really difficult balance. Governors walking this tightrope. They have to balance keeping people healthy and also making sure their economies don't crater. You've got to get people back to work at a certain point. Now, speaking of getting people back to work, the president has ordered meatpacking plants to stay open despite thousands of workers there getting sick. At least 20 people have died. What is so important here, JJ, for us to know, especially when we're talking about the country's supply chain when it comes to food and keeping that secure, but also keeping workers safe?
The first thing that's important is that there is not a food shortage. Last week, I spoke with Tom Vilsack, the former governor of Iowa, and he was also the former agriculture secretary. In fact, I think he was the longest serving cabinet member under former President Barack Obama. And he said to me, there simply is not a food shortage. The problem is a disruption in the supply chain's ability to deliver food. A good example of that was their farmers that were dairy farmers, because he's the CEO and president of the Dairy Export Council now. They were producing milk, continuing to produce it. But when the COVID-19 pandemic forced lockdowns and shutdowns here in the U.S., a lot of their users weren't using it. The grocery stores were not ordering as much milk, because what they were doing because of panic buying was limiting what people could buy. Schools shut down, so kids weren't at school drinking milk. So they ended up dumping, and this is according to Vilsack, millions of pounds of milk. And we've heard the same about food. So the second thing is going back to work at meat plants and places that have the disease or the virus there is a very delicate situation. The president wants to reopen these, make sure they stay open. And I think he's enacted the Defense Production Act to make sure they stay open. It's got to be done based on the people like Vilsack and the medical folks I've spoken to, in a very, very careful way to make sure that those people are safe, to make sure that the food supply is intact. And there could be a shortage if that's not done appropriately. But at this point, there isn't a shortage. There simply is a disruption in the way the food is being delivered. And going back to work at these meatpacking plants and other places is something that's got to be looked at very carefully.
Right. And of course, will workers want to return? Okay, let's take a break and we will continue this discussion when we get back. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on VOA's website at voanews.com. Now back to our panel, J.J. Green, national correspondent for WTOP and host of the Target USA podcast, and Richard Lechten-Dress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada. Before the break, we were talking about workers getting sick at these meatpacking plants, the president ordering these plants to remain open because they are critical to the nation's food supply. Now, one thing we're hearing from workers is that they need to be given access to proper protective equipment, and also they want to see daily testing. And we have seen that testing is so crucial to slowing down the virus. You know, the U.S. has ramped up testing. Over 5 million people have been tested. But some experts say we need to test 5 million people a day to safely reopen the country. And on this issue, we are getting confusing signals because the president told a reporter we'd get to that 5 million number soon. But then you had the administration's testing czar saying that number, it's impossible to get that every day. We don't even need that. The president later backtracking, claiming he never said we would reach the 5 million number a day. Richard, what do you make of all of these sort of confusing messages coming on testing?
Well, I think it shows that it's very hard to figure out exactly how to process all the tests that could be done, but there are differences from one state to the other for the access to the testing, for the access to the right results from these testing. What we hear from the White House, definitely as Dr. Deborah Birx has confirmed around the president, that the task force that the vice president is managing, that there's been a definite increase in the number has being done. And there was a challenge this week at the White House, and she said that now, even if people were debating if South Korea was doing more or less, the Americans have been doing more. The problem is definitely that you just cannot reach the level where you would want to. This said, now in California, in the Los Angeles area, people have more and more access to these tests. So the problem, again, is this will to send a positive message from the White House, a positive message to the American people that things are getting better. We are indeed having a clear picture. Obviously, experts say we do not. We have this over a million cases in the U.S., but it's probably far higher than this, but it's simply because what we get back from the states and what is sent back from the White House does not necessarily fit the same perspective as for the message we want to throw back to them.
Right. And as you point out, there are likely more than 1 million people who have the virus here in the U.S. and other countries, too. It appears that they're underreporting, or they haven't been able to test to know who has the virus and who doesn't. And JJ, to that point, when we look at countries around the world, when it comes to testing, what are you seeing?
Well, it's interesting you asked that question, Shayna, because just yesterday, and I do this on a regular basis, a daily, is engage with intelligence officials to the degree that I can overseas, and with other colleagues like Richard and the great work that he's doing with his outlet. And the Canadians are always a good source of truth when it comes to this kind of thing. But I was talking with a friend of mine in Italy yesterday, and the Italian daily, Corriere della Sera, came out yesterday with a story indicating that there are 1,200 people in Lombardy, which is where Milan is, hard hit Milan, in January that had COVID-19. And this was just days after China had just said, yeah, we have a cluster of cases that are what we believe pneumonia. The bottom line on this is the story from that newspaper is based on interviews and based on documentation from medical professionals in Italy, suggest that the COVID-19 virus was out and circulating long before the Chinese said anything about it and long before we here in the U.S. realized that we had it. I think the bottom line on that is that it was likely here in the States a lot sooner, and there may be a lot more people that have had it, a lot more people that were sick and didn't know it, because in China, they were still calling it pneumonia. And here, I think I heard New York's Governor Cuomo say early on in this, a lot of people have had this and have recovered on their own. So one of the things that is really seriously being looked at overseas and needs to be looked at here, I think there are those that are planning to do that, is just how early did this get here? That's one of the reasons why the president is continually asked, when did he know and what did he know, is when did this virus first touch our shores?
Right. And that's why U.S. officials want to know more from China, because China's being accused of downplaying the virus in the early weeks, not alerting the rest of the world to what could be coming to their shores. But how does the U.S. and other nations hold China accountable when at the same time, this is a global effort where countries need to be working together to combat this virus, JJ?
I think that's kind of a two-part thing there. And how does the U.S. and the rest of the world get their arms around it to go deal with this? And I think you've seen some brilliant examples of that, where countries have been sharing resources and been working together to try to come up with solutions and to do the things that are necessary to do. And for all of its failings on this, the White House has been pretty hard on China, because China really has not been forthcoming in this. This is the second part of this. China really has not been forthcoming on all of the developments on this. First of all, you know, because they were slow and reluctant to tell the world what was going on. But then after it became a problem, then you see situations like what's happening with Australia, where China is saying, okay, well, we're going to, you know, you have problems with us because of the coronavirus. We're going to change our trade policy with you. And with the U.S., there are threats that they're withholding or will withhold pharmaceutical ingredients, which the U.S. depends heavily on China for. Those are two parts of a very complex picture that needs to be worked out before this can be dealt with. And frankly speaking, I'm not sure that we're anywhere close to working this out, because the Chinese government, they're going to get sued. Let's just be honest about it. It's going to happen sooner or later. If everybody in the world sues China, that's just not going to work. But the bottom line on it is, in that case, there has to be more willingness on the part of the Chinese government to engage and to allow officials to come there and to investigate and to figure out just what happened, when it happened, and where it started.
Right. And obviously, this is going to be a big issue when this virus threat passes, and we can sort of deal with those issues. Richard, you obviously have a global view, too. Your network is based in Canada. What are you seeing from the different countries and how they are handling the virus? What's standing out to you?
Well, what's standing out to me, Shana, is that I've been following Francophone countries, French-speaking countries, even a little closer, what's happening in France and Belgium and Switzerland and Africa, where the virus has not been moving these recently as fast as in other places. Is the first reality is that, just like over here, people are worried to go back to work, but a lot of people need to do something because their own means have been going down, their needs are still there, and they need to find ways to improve their daily lives. So what I've seen as for fighting the virus itself, confinement has been very tightly respected in most places, and it's very impressive. And the same thing as for social distancing in Canada, for instance. And it's, I just want to use the Canadian example, because JJ very generously described how the Canadians are coming forwards with their information. But I was noticing in New Zealand, in Australia, Emmanuel Macron and friends too, people give press briefings and press points, press conferences that are rich in scientific information and social description of what people should be doing and expecting. And I think that's what's been very helpful in these places where you've seen, I would say, a calming down a little bit of the tension of remaining inside and not being able to do one's normal life. So New Zealand is a perfect example of this reality. While it's been very complicated in Brazil, for instance, with President Bolsonaro sending exactly the wrong messages, to the point where here at the White House, even if President Trump keeps repeating that he's a friend, he's now considering not stopping flights from Brazil, but having passengers on flights coming from South America and Brazil in particular being tested before getting onto the plane, because he now doesn't even trust his friend in the Southern Hemisphere.
A lot to unpack there. We have lots to discuss here, but we got through a lot. Gentlemen, thank you so much. JJ Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and the host of Target USA podcast, and Richard Lechton-Gress, Correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada. This program is produced by the Voice of America, and I'm Shana Stulen. Thanks for listening.